You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. PBS has been airing underwriting announcements from the Republic of Saudi Arabia, and many are up in arms over what seems to be a conflict of interest. There's concern that this practice could compromise PBS's ability to accurately report on Saudi Arabia's role in the war on terrorism. With so many restrictions placed on the U.S. media during the Afghanistan conflict, it is unclear what role the media will play in the Middle East if war against Iraq is officially declared. Peace Watch spoke with Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting.
Well, my basic belief about that is that public broadcasting shouldn't be taking any ads at all, period. In fact, that's the whole point of public broadcasting, is to provide programming that advertisers of any sort don't necessarily want to sponsor. So I think that news outlets shouldn't be taking money from people and groups that they're covering. But to me, it really doesn't matter so much whether it's Saudi Arabia or General Electric. I think Saudi Arabia's sponsorship may seem striking to us now, geopolitically, right at this moment, but it isn't inherently more of a conflict than public broadcasting taking money from, say, a defense contractor, in my opinion.
And is that primarily based on the theory that this person, this entity, this government, in this case, would have an influence over the type of programming that the station does?
Well, that is, of course, ultimately the concern, but the general journalistic principle is that conflict of interest is in the mind of the audience. It's based on the perception. The question is, am I at home seeing that Saudi Arabia or General Electric or General Dynamics has given money to this media outlet, and then that media outlet is going on to report on Saudi Arabia, General Electric, or General Dynamics, or issues that directly influence them? Well, in my mind, that presents a conflict. That makes me ask questions about the impartiality and the independence of the coverage. Mm-hmm. Of course, the reporters can say, well, we weren't directly influenced by the fact that Saudi Arabia bought an ad, but the question is really, what are the questions that it raises for me, the viewer? We understand why Saudi Arabia wants to take this moment to change or influence public perceptions of them, but it's reporters' job to stay independent from that.
Well, is it likely to have an effect on the wartime news coverage?
Well, I think it's going to have an effect on all kinds of coverage, but I think at a time of war where we're really looking for independence, and independence is harder to come by, we've got journalists, you know, now going to camp with the military and so on, then these questions of independence really do come to the fore. And you have to remember that corporate media owners are always, they rely on Congress for these deregulatory laws that are making them rich. So they really are part and parcel of the whole system that they're supposed to be watchdogging.
Well, you mentioned the camps, and we know that there was an article in the current edition of the Columbia Journalism Review about the U.S. military running special training sessions for journalists who they claim will be given access to cover war from the front lines. Does collaboration between the media and the military raise any ethical questions?
Well, absolutely. I think, first of all, these military camps, they serve the Pentagon's purposes of having journalists identify with the military, but they're actually no guarantee at all that reporters will have access when it's really important in the field. And I think we have to remember the reason that the military feels they need this quality time with reporters right now is because everyone knows that access in Afghanistan was so terrible. Even mainstream reporters were complaining that they couldn't get near a lot of sites that they wanted to reach. And one Washington Post reporter, Doug Strzok, was even threatened with shooting by a military official. So that's why the military is making this special outreach to journalists to make journalists feel that they're on the team.
Also, these camps and another method that is used at wartime is pool reporting. It seems to basically neutralize any sense of competition among the journalists themselves, which on the one hand, one might say, well, that's good. But on the other hand, where is that drive and that motivation to really get out there and get the story that no one else is going to be telling?
Exactly. Pool reporting is really just a form of censorship. You know, it means that every picture you take, every person you interview, it always has to be vetted by a military official. So it's really censorious directly. But then just as you say, it does sort of guarantee that every journalist is going to get basically the same story. And that's really not what we're looking for. We're looking for those enterprising folks who will go maybe off the beaten path and get a story that is not handed to them on a platter by the military.
At the same time, what is the responsibility of the journalist during wartime? The Pentagon would have us believe that, you know, there's certain top secret information that really could jeopardize the nation's safety or security, and that the journalists should be more sensitive to that and honor those.
I think it's absolutely right that journalists should not be in the business of putting anyone's life in danger. But I think we actually have seen journalists not come very close to that line. You know, that's something to be concerned about, but it's not really the problem that we have. The problem we have is much more of a lack of access, of reporters not being up close enough to get the story.
Have there ever really been any incidents throughout history where information that was reported actually compromised the national security of this country?
Well, you know, the story that we hear is that this was the problem of Vietnam. And my understanding from things that have been written about that time is that, in fact, it really wasn't the case that journalists were reporting troop movements and things that were actually putting people's lives in danger. There may be examples of individual journalists. As a matter of fact, I can think of one, Geraldo Rivera from Fox News carrying a gun in Afghanistan. That actually is a compromising thing that a quote-unquote journalist has done, because it raises the suspicion among many people that all journalists will be armed, and it makes them potential targets. But I don't think that's the type of thing people are talking about when they talk about journalists making problems for the military.
Even before the formal official war gets underway, and we know that we've seen an acceleration of the bombing by the U.S. in the so-called no-fly zone, it seems as though the journalists in the Washington press corps, and even wider than that, mainstream corporate media, they're not pool reporting, but the stories are coming out much the same. And yet people will say, well, you know, you're just a conspiracist or something. That's ridiculous. The journalists don't get together and decide what to report. What is your take on that?
It may be the case that journalists don't all get together and decide what to report, but I'm pretty comfortable talking about an institutional climate in the elite media outlets of this country where the disturbing fact is you don't need to be told what to report. They have internalized a notion of the proper boundaries that they are not allowed to transgress. And really, I think in the U.S. media, we have to be as much or more concerned about self-censorship than we do about any censorship from the administration.
Mm. So if you had to judge the media coverage leading up to this war or around this whole topic or issue of impending war with Iraq, one grade for media coverage, what would it be?
Well, I would have to say they're failing, because you have to compare it to what they should be doing. Asking hard questions, providing debate, showing a range of opinion, and championing free speech and freedom of speech. And there's just no way I can say that that's what they're doing.
Janine Jackson of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. As people nationwide prepare to march on Washington, D.C. this Saturday to oppose a war on Iraq, Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch's producer from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, conducted a roundtable to address the role of racism and prejudice in the buildup for a war against Iraq. She hosted Peta Lindsay, the youth and student coordinator of ANSWER, or Act Now to Stop the War in Racism, Ismail Kamal, Muslim Students Association in the U.S. and Canada, and Ismail Royers with the Muslim American Society, and Damo Smith, the founder of Black Voices for Peace. Lindsay addressed the racism of the recruitment.
What I've seen at my schools is that young people, and particularly young people of color, are recruited in greater numbers by those representing the U.S. military. And of course they target people of color. They're targeting people that don't have as many educational options. They're targeting people who they think be more likely to want that place in society and have less funds for continuing their education and don't really have the options to do something different with their lives. It's for those in power who would never send their own sons or daughters over to fight these wars of aggression, to be killed and to kill in their senseless wars. They are the ones that call for these wars, yet we are the ones they send to fight them. And that's why it's really important for youth and students, particularly youth and students of color, to stand up against this sort of thing.
Ismail Kamal, Muslim Students Association in the U.S. and Canada.
Also, another issue is that racism and prejudice manifested in foreign policy. Iraq is being supposedly disarmed, and a war is possibly being built up against Iraq because it supposedly has weapons of mass destruction. A few miles to the west, Israel, that continues to oppress Palestinians, has the nuclear bombs, about 12 or so, has engaged in wars against its Arab neighbors. Israel has launched an attack against it, continues to oppress Palestinians, yet there is no call to disarm Israel. I think that is a manifestation of racism in the choice of how wars are launched and what countries that we choose to disarm or so, or to create a regime change.
How about prejudice? You're Muslim, Ismail Royer, but you're of European descent.
This administration has been picking a fight in a number of ways, and I think was extremely pleased with, for example, the September 11th attacks. I think they're extremely pleased to be able to so easily pick a fight with Iraq because they benefit from constant war and constant perception of threat so that they can implement an agenda that the Republican Party and extremists within the Republican Party have been wanting to implement ever since many of their powers were taken away in the wake of the scandals with the FBI, the CIA assassinations, and domestic spying. And the Clinton administration, that although far from perfect, did not implement the far-right agenda that Ashcroft and the people around Bush want. So I think that all these things are simply excuses to begin getting back some of the draconian powers and to begin again the militarization of our economy and of our world.
Ismail Kamal.
I had mentioned that for the last 20 years or so, we can date back to the Iranian Revolution, that focus has been brought to the Middle East as never before, particularly with the Palestinian issue, how the Palestinian issue is portrayed in the media, and how Arabs and Muslims are being portrayed in media as terrorists. I mean, first in the 60s, the Arabs were portrayed as camel jockeys and backward people. Then in the 70s, as the oil rich sheikh and the Yom Kippur War and so forth, and how Arabs were portrayed then. In the 80s and the 90s, and now Arabs are being portrayed as, and Muslims are being portrayed as, terrorists. So really, the background, the atmosphere of hatred towards Arabs and Muslims is prior to 9/11. Some laws during the Clinton administration, particularly the Omnibus Counterterrorism Bill, was introduced in 96. 9/11 exploded with anti-Arab and anti-Muslim legislation, and it became institutionalized.
But the thing is that if the Omnibus Counterterrorism Act in 96 came after the Oklahoma City bombing, and still it had to be fought for. And if you look at who was fighting for it behind the scenes, it was an extreme fringe coalition of, honestly, nutcase groups connected with groups like the Falange and the Middle East, their front groups here, and groups who have an agenda against Muslims. And so these are the groups behind it. But the Patriot Act after 9/11 sailed through, you know. And so the point is that these kind of incidents really benefit those fringe people in the U.S. who are agitating for a clash of civilizations. These kind of incidents are the dream of these people who want to implement this kind of police state in the United States.
Peter Lindsay.
They are portraying, you know, demonizing the Muslim and Arab population in this country with the hopes of making the people of this country so afraid of their Muslim brothers and sisters that they will not stand up and fight for them, that they will not stand up and fight with them in order to preserve all of our rights across the board. And that's the only way that this sort of measures can be defeated, is if we create an alliance of all people in this country who want to stand up and defend our rights.
In addition, to racism being a factor, also there is religious prejudice. I mean, we cannot neglect the comments that were made by people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Franklin Graham, were extremely anti-Islamic, and comments that were made against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. I mean, there is a religious agenda from the far right in this country to demonize Muslims and Islam, in addition to the racial aspect of discrimination, prejudice against Arabs and Muslims.
Damu Smith, Black Voices for Peace.
Well, one of the things I wanted to mention is that it's important for all of us as we work on these issues to remember the genesis of racism historically in this country. Racism emerged out of the process of the slave trade and the building of the slave system in the United States and the war against the indigenous people who were the original inhabitants of this land to clear the way for capitalist expansion in the United States. So, genocide was committed against the Native Americans, and black people were brought here as slaves and worked as chattel slaves for centuries with no pay. Racism, therefore, has been a product of this society from day one. It is embedded in our Constitution because black people were counted only as 3/5 of a human being in the original electoral political counts. And therefore, when we look at it that way, we understand how racism has been woven into every institution in our society, because it has been used not only for the super exploitation of black people and other people of color, but also of workers and for immigrant people. It has been used to divide and drive a wedge between white and black and people of color and white people, and to sow confusion so that those in power can remain in power and misdirect people's attention from who the real enemy is, and to scapegoat people like Muslims and African Americans and other people of color.
Ismail Royers, Muslim American Society. How about ignorance? Which role does it play? Are a lot of people converting to Islam in this country?
There's said to be between 6 and 7 million Muslims in the United States, and surveys of mosque attendance show that about 50% of Muslims in the United States are immigrants, and about 50% are indigenous, African-American overwhelmingly, and minorities like myself, white, and increasing number of Hispanics. And I think that these kind of things don't do much to dissuade people from learning about Islam and becoming more tolerant, because people who have generally good hearts, like the people in this room and many, many people listening, of course, have a tendency towards the truth, you know, and once these kind of issues come up and they start trying to learn more, they'll learn the truth of the matter and not really listen to Jerry Falwell. But what I wanted to say also is how crucial and how important and what it really is, for me, a staggering historical development it is, that we're seeing these coalitions forming across the lines, immigrants, African-Americans. I'm told that many Hispanic groups now are in discussion with the anti-war group. These kind of developments are very, very dangerous for those who have a stake in maintaining the racial divide. Immigrants are beginning to wake up and to realize, just as the Irish had to, that they were not considered white, you know, and that they weren't going to automatically get their civil rights, and that they have to really study and really connect and really empathize and really learn from the African-American experience, because that's what it's all about. This is a model for struggling for justice in this country, and so we just want to say how much we appreciate and value this budding coalition that we're seeing.
And this is going to be very important at this period of time. We need unity in our movement. We need unity across racial lines, cultural lines, religious lines, because in unity there is power. We're not dealing with a paper tiger when we're dealing with the United States of America. We're dealing with a very powerful, well-armed system of oppression that is global in its reach and that is racist in its nature. And we have to understand that the degree to which we can forge unity is the degree to which we can make a difference in terms of U.S. policy and building a new vision of a new society, not only in the United States, but throughout the world.
The Irish became white. So how do you understand that? A lot of Arabs were also trying to pass, or thought they're passing, and suddenly they were surprised to be profiled. Ismail Kamal.
And I think one of the problems that many immigrants face is that there is a concept of identity that is forced upon them, race. Race is not really a factor, particularly in Africa and the Middle East and Asia, as a term that identifies people. People usually identify the religion, tribe, ethnicity, or even nationality. Even that is still an issue that many are struggling, since the borders of many of the countries that exist in the Middle East and Africa and Asia are borders constructed by former colonial powers. So identity being forced upon immigrants has created a problem for many who have come to this country and have tried to blend in. For example, many Arab immigrants that have come to the United States, particularly from North Africa or from the greater Syria region, have identified themselves in the past as being white. Well, you know, 9/11 comes, and even before 9/11, but
I was surprised to become white. I was like, I can't be white. I'm not European.
For the conscious people, definitely that is the case. But I mean, there are those in the Arab community that for many years have believed that they were white, and this is actually alienated many other Arabs, since, you know, being an Arab itself is broad, and it's a cultural and linguistic term more than racial, that created was a topic of discussion and debate within the Arab community. Come 9/11, many Arabs realized that they are actually not white. So can be said about many other immigrant communities. Some have blended in, some have not. So I think now, since 9/11, many Arab communities and the Muslim community also have realized that they need to associate themselves with the experiences of other communities, particularly African-American and Chicano-Latino communities, because they've become victims of racism and need to learn from the experiences, particularly the civil rights movement, of how to deal with this issue.
P. Pita Lindsay, the student organizer of UNSWER, Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism.
And also, we have come to the point where there are those in the African-American community who identify more closely with the white establishment than they do with their own communities, and it's more of a class divide than a racial divide at this point. There are the Colin Powells or the Condoleezza Rices who say, well, you know, I made it, and so it means that every other African-American can, and they don't understand that there are massive disparities on the whole of the entire community in terms of those who that don't have the same educational opportunities, that weren't born as privileges, will never be in a position to have their interests tied up with those in power in the United States. And so it's really important for African Americans to understand that it's not just a matter of them as an individual, of their family making it, of them getting by, and of them going without persecution, but it's a matter of the people as a whole advancing, and the people as a whole, you know, coming forward.
I'm a European American or white convert to Islam, and I converted 10 years ago, and I've spent a total of probably 3 or more years overseas and in Muslim countries. And then when I come back here, I come face to face with one thing that I value very much that I learned from since becoming Muslim. And that is really that fundamentally race is completely irrelevant. It's totally irrelevant. And it's relevant in the United States to from an external sense as how people see you and in an anthropological, sociological sense, right? But I think that it would be a mistake for Muslims in the United States to begin sort of internalizing this really, you know, artificial, you know, construct of race that we in America really suffer from.
Can I just say, I wish we were at a point where we could say that race is irrelevant, but we really can't. It is a reality that's forced upon the African-American community, that's forced upon people of color, not only in the way that they are perceived, but in the way they are dealt with and the realities that they face every day in their lives. And so we do have to work for the advancement of people of color as a whole, is what I'm saying. That's across national lines, it's across ethnic lines, and just to get to the point where we can be at the same level and so that we can claim that race is not a relevant issue, so that and, you know, it's not until those barriers are broken down that it will be irrelevant. And I really think that's an important point for people in the United States to understand that working and poor people in this country have more in common with the people of Iraq than they do with the people in power in this country right now. And that's a really important point to keep in mind when you go about your daily business, when you look at the demonization that you see on the TV, that you have more in common with the people that are under attack than with the country that attacks them in your name.
A roundtable discussion on racism and war in the context of 9/11 and the impending war with Iraq from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington. Speaking to an enthusiastic crowd at a peace rally in Los Angeles last weekend, actor Martin Sheen weighs in on the impending war with Iraq. Actor Rob Lowe from the cast of The West Wing introduces Sheen.
On behalf of the acting president of the United States, I want to thank you for coming out today. You know, people come up to me at events like this all the time and they say, Mr. Lowe, what do you know about politics? You're a schmuck on a TV show. And maybe they have a point. Maybe we should leave our public discourse up to oil executives who got rich off companies that went bankrupt. I am here as a father. I'm tired of picking up the newspaper and seeing the future of my children being attacked. Let's look at this guy's record, job creation into job elimination, surplus into deficit, environmental protection into environmental evisceration. And even more outrageous is we see this guy using all the tremendous political capital generated by our fear about the war on terrorism to push a radical right-wing agenda that has nothing to do with national security. None of the vast political capital generated by the war on terrorism has been used to move us away from our dangerous and wasteful dependence on foreign oil. And of course, none of the vast political capital has been used to build a coalition to fight terror itself. Just a year after the horrible attacks in New York, our standing with our allies has never been lower. This is an incredible achievement. We need to fight. We need to make sure that for my children and for your children, that the ultimate legacy of this country is not the vengeance with which we act like warmongers, but the compassion with which we wage peace. Now, with no further ado, ladies and gentlemen, a man who I love, who has spent his celebrity fighting for peace and justice in this world, my dear friend, the acting president of the United States, Martin Sheen!
Thank you, Brad. Thank you all. Peace be with you. Thank you. Thank you. We need to be reminded that we can no longer afford to remain silent because we have learned from history that silence becomes cowardice when occasion demands speaking out the truth and acting accordingly. And so we gather here today with a new hope and confidence in the old adage, if the people lead, the leaders will follow. We have a far different point of view of the world than our leadership. We have a far different vision of our place in the world and our responsibility to its people. We want to end our long and shameful silence here today and in one strong, clear, and united voice say no to death and war and yes to life so that we may be made worthy of the long-promised blessing reserved for the peacemakers. From this time forth, may all our thoughts, words, and deeds be a nonviolent response to violence or be worthless as we lift up the world and all its people to a place where the heart is without fear and the head is held high, where knowledge is free, where the world has not been broken up into fragments by narrow domestic walls, where words come out from the depths of truth, where tireless striving stretches its arms towards perfection, where the clear stream of reason has not lost its way into the dreary desert sands of dead habit, where the mind is led forward by thee into ever-widening thought and action, into that heaven of freedom, my Father. Let my country awake. Thank you.
Actor Martin Sheen in Los Angeles. This segment was produced by Dan Pavlish of Pacifica Station KPFK. Tracy Chapman, Tell It Like It Is. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance this evening from Jim Bennett of KPFA, Keith Shalajan, Penny Gamble Williams, Jabari Zakia, and Bentha Berklin. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we invite you to visit Pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or send us your checks and money orders to 2390 Champlain Street, Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Thank you for listening. So everyone can hear.